Your chance for greatness lies. Seize that chance and let no power on earth deter you. In the trainer's room, Alan Stewart, the Odessa police chief, was on the phone making sure there was a police escort for the buses. Two police cars showed up, and the buses made their way to the stadium in a swirling wind that sent little veins of dust down the empty road like slithering snakes. About 1,500 fans from Nimitz were already there, some of them having made the 330-mile trip in chartered Greyhound buses that were shoe-polished on the side with the words, "We love you, Blue." When the first group of Nimitz players took the field for the pregame warm-up, the blue-clad, bell-ringing, flag-waving supporters rose to their feet. "Go, Vikes, go! Go, Vikes, go! Go, Vikes, go!" On the field, Walker ran side by side with his teammate in the backfield and best friend, Byron Miles. They ran in such beautiful sync that they looked for a moment like Siamese twins. And they had the cocky jaunt that all athletes have when they want to draw attention to themselves quietly. The stride smooth and effortless. The enormous phalanx of the Permian band, led by the majorettes in their black velvet costumes, unfolded like the Russian army in a Victory Day parade in Moscow. Not a single person was out of step. Not a single costume looked droopy or saggy. The band made its traditional circle around the stadium, not even remotely rattled by the tireless efforts of the Nimitz fans to drown it out with their continued rosaries. "Go, Vikes, go! Go, Vikes, go! Go, Vikes, go!" Minutes before kickoff, Gaines called the team around him in the stadium dressing room. For the first time all season, he had the players exactly where he wanted them. The letter, whoever had written it, had achieved its intended effect. They were angry, enraged, humiliated. You could feel it. Losers? They would show the world who was a loser. "They're out there hollering for Mojo," said Gaines of the Nimitz fans. "We're going to give a little dose of Mojo. You got it?"
"Yes, sir."
"Mojo's going to be the 11 on the field wearing black jerseys. You understand that?"
"Yes, sir."
"I hope all of you have prepared yourself to call on something extra, call on something extra from within you that's going to allow you to play even better than you've ever played in your life. A supreme, fanatical, wild-eyed effort that it's going to take to win this football game. Emotion, enthusiasm, intensity for 4 quarters. 4 quarters. Can you go 4 quarters?
"Yes, sir."
He bent down in the middle of the circle and led the team in prayer, as he did before every game. "Dear God, we're thankful for this day. We're thankful for this opportunity you've given us to display the talent that you've blessed us with. Heavenly Father, we thank you for these men and these black jerseys. Thank you for the ability that you've given them and the character that you've given them. And we ask your blessings on each one of them this afternoon. Help them, dear God, to play to the very best of their ability. Help them to play with some quality that they've never played with before. Give them that something extra that they've never had to call up before." On the first play from scrimmage, the great Roderick Walker took the ball on a pitch. He moved to the right side, looking for the tiny sliver of space he needed to break up field with his 4-4 speed, just as he had done against Trimble Tech and Arlington and L.D. Bell and Holtham. But he wasn't prepared for the mass of black shirts coming at him in a crazy blur, like hungry rats jumping over each other's backs to get to a speck of food. He tried to dodge, to somehow get out of the way, at least make it to the sideline and regroup a bit. But who the hell were these people? What possessed them? Defensive tackle Billy Steen clawed into him first, and Payne came from the outside linebacker position and dove into him at full speed. On Payne's back, dying for a little piece of the meat as well, was Ivory Christian, and right behind Ivory were other tacklers, equally desperate to dismember Roderick Walker. Jared McDougal was right. It was like Imperial Rome, like the Christians and the Lions, violent, visceral, exciting, crazy. And Walker was about to become a sacrifice, with 12,000 fans screaming at the top of their lungs to finish him off, their thumbs raised so high to the sky they could almost touch it. Walker was crushed, a pile of black shirts burying him so you couldn't even see him anymore. The roar of the crowd grew louder and louder. A helmet hit him where he cradled the ball. It popped into the air like a lazily floating balloon. It was caught by defensive back Stan Wilkins for the fumble recovery. Two plays later, Comer took off for a 49-yard touchdown run. With 22 seconds gone, the game was over. The vaunted Walker managed a total of 1 yard on 7 carries in the first half as Permian went into the locker room with a 27-0 lead against a team that had come into the game ranked 6th in the state. The final score was 48-7. Walker ended up with 71 yards on 15 carries. Comer had 221 yards on 26 carries and 4 touchdowns. The Nimitz fans, shamed but loyal to the bitter end, started chanting, "We love you! We love you!" to their ever-noble heroes. On the other side, the Permian players marched about giving each other high fives, eager to take advantage of the fact that they still owned the town for another Saturday night, as if they were legally licensed desperados, and some of them seemed doubly inspired by the letter they had found in their lockers, as well as by the discovery of a new, far more elegant word for the more traditional shit-faced. "Shit, no!" said Don Billingsley, when asked if he was going to cut down on the post-party celebrations that night. "I'm going to party, see how intoxicated I can get, and how many rules I can flaunt. That's my motto." After the game ended, the trophy commemorating the win was held aloft, a golden football mounted on a pedestal. Permian had so many of these by now that there was no longer room for them in the school trophy case, and some of them sat atop the refrigerator in the coach's office as ignominiously as empty pop bottles. But there was still something magical about getting one, and dozens of hands reached out to touch it, to feel its smooth, gleaming surface, and draw sustenance from it, to keep the wonderful moment going forever, to join the illustrious pantheon of those who had actually made it, who had gone to state. It was during times like this that they suddenly became resurrected again. Bizzell, Shipman, Mann, Hassel, Dale, Hicks, Williams. Their pictures appeared on the wall of fame as in a shrine to eternal youth. Men who, no matter how old they were, no matter what they had done or hadn't done, whether they had become lawyers or car thieves, whether they were happily married or had the beaten, sucked-in look of divorce, whether they were successful or were still groping to rekindle that indescribable moment when everything was all right and the entire world flickered beneath them with outstretched arms and every man looked jealous and every woman looked like a lover, whether they missed the game beyond their wildest dreams or had come to hate it beyond their wildest dreams, would always, always be thought of in cleats and pads, and a helmet with a P on the side that burned as brightly as the sun. Part 2. He remembered the turning point, as everyone who had ever been there always did. "Here's the pass." On the video, Jerry Hicks faked to the fullback, dropped back, and hit the tight end for a touchdown. At that point, right there, I knew we had him. The play had taken place 8 years before, 5 days before Christmas. The breathless voices of the announcers came on over the video. He sat on the couch and listened in silence. "All season long, we've talked about Jerry Hicks to an extent making this Panther team go." Sitting there and watching this, still, it gives me a feeling. Feel kind of awed all over, like you're down on the field sweating.
And Hicks scores from a yard and a half out.
On the screen, he dove into the end zone for the touchdown, impossibly small to be playing football. 5'8 and 135 pounds, and yet not only was he playing football, he was excelling at it. He was the embodiment of the myth that had made Permian so enormously popular. Small, overachieving, white, fearless. Two teammates helped pull him up to his feet like a beaten-up rag doll. On the screen, he got up slowly, and there was the slight shaking of a fist. I guess I'm reliving. He reached to the coffee table to check his stats. He remembered halftime when Coach Kennedy came in and kicked a trash can across the room with the team down 19-7. He knew the plays before they appeared on the screen. We got here and ran 30 trap up the middle. Then we throw the little dunk pass, try a reverse ride here. 236 pass. I hit the flanker on this one. I think we ran 29 here, sent the back in motion. He watched the team score to take the lead. He watched the defense hold, only to fumble on the very next play. Well, this is a play I hate. I felt like crap when I went to the sidelines. That killed me. I thought I saw the hole inside, and it closed up. I went to the sideline and took off my helmet and was damn near in tears. On the screen, the team scored late in the fourth quarter to ice the game for good. Everyone knew Permian had done it. Achieved one of the great upsets in the modern history of Texas schoolboy sports. They had won the state championship. I'd give anything to go back out there. It was wrong to think that life had been unkind to him. It was just different now from what it had been then. He had a nice house he had gotten on a mortgage repo for $48,000. He had a lovely wife and a lovely baby girl and two adorable stepdaughters. He had run the 40 and 4.7, and he was all state, but because of his size, he knew there wasn't a college in the world that had use for him as a football player. He had gone to the junior college in town, Odessa College, but then left after a year to work full-time at Odessa Builder Supply. He rose to shop foreman, and then had quit the previous summer to start his own company, Brasas Door and Hardware. But something was missing, and he wasn't ashamed to admit that the only way to remember what it was like was to pull out that worn video every month or so. It was a way of getting back there, just as his parents still kept his room filled with memorabilia. A picture of the championship team, a statue of a Black Panther that he had carefully put back together after it had been broken, a framed article and picture given to him by the Booster Club, a collage made for him by his Pepette. We were hoarse from screaming and yelling. We didn't want to leave the field. When he finally did, he remembered dozens of kids calling to him for his chin strap or his mouthpiece or his arm pad or his earpiece. All these kids begging for a piece of Jerry Hicks, begging for a piece of the quarterback of the state champions of Texas. It wasn't a matter of feeling like Roger Staubach or Terry Bradshaw or a quarterback who had just won the Super Bowl. It was a matter of their not knowing what Jerry Hicks felt at that incredible moment, unless they too had gone to state and won it. I miss it. Like I say, if I could, I'd go back and relive that moment. Nothing can compare. I miss it. I guess that's why I have season tickets and go to the games. I don't want to be apart from it. At the public pep rally out at the stadium the Thursday before the quarterfinal showdown against the Arlington Lamar Vikings, Hicks stood on the glittering field. About 5,000 people were there, and when he came to the microphone to give a short speech, they rose and honored him with a standing ovation, because they would be thankful to him forever. There were a lot of people who didn't think we had much of a chance to win district, let alone a state championship, Hicks told all those loyalists in the stands. But we believed in ourselves and each other. We believed in our hearts. There were several more introductions of former players that night, and there were dozens more who would have gotten the same adulation, the same standing ovations for deeds done 5 or 10 or 15 years ago, still remembered by everyone as if they hadn't changed a single bit. There were players like Joe Bob Bissell, the golden boy of golden boys, the one against whom all others were measured. Said one former classmate of him with dreamy reverence as he remembered Joe Bob's place and time in high school in the early 70s, "You couldn't touch him. He had been All-State 3 years, making it as a sophomore, as a junior, and then both ways at receiver and defensive back as a senior. No one else at Permian had ever done that, and no one had an instinct for the ball like Joe Bob Bissell. Something that rose beyond a rare gift, a natural talent, and had become a very part of him. Before they even snapped the ball, I knew what play they were going to run," he said. "It was weird, but that's how it was done." He wasn't big, 5'7", and 132 pounds, but he had become the Paul Bunyan of Odessa. No story about him too tall, no feet too outlandish. On the edge of the practice field, boosters gently argued with one another over how many people he had knocked out on a single play. One booster pegged it at 1, another said 2, another said 3. They smiled as they recalled the glory of Joe Bob Bissell, and it was impossible not to think of the little picture of him on the Wall of Fame, in which he was adorable-looking. His easygoing smile seeming to imply that he knew exactly where his life was headed. Despite his size, he had been too good a prospect to pass up. He got heavily recruited and ended up going to the University of Texas in 1973 when the legendary Darryl Royal was still the coach. Toward the end of his senior year at Permian, he had had an accident in the school parking lot when he drove his motorcycle while drunk and skidded. He lost a lot of blood and skin on the left side of his face and the left shoulder and left knee, and Darryl Royal called him up, of course, to see if he could still play, and when he said he could, everything was okay again. He had played for Texas as a freshman on a team that went to the Cotton Bowl and had on it two future big-time pros, Doug English and Raymond Claiborne. In a Thanksgiving Day rout of Texas A&M, he intercepted 2 passes that helped set up scores. In a 19-3 Cotton Bowl loss to Nebraska, he started at safety and was in on 9 tackles and intercepted a pass. Darryl Royal bragged about him on national television, and Joe Bob Bissell seemed to have made it until the following fall. When Raymond Claiborne, who was faster and bigger than Joe Bob Bissell was or ever would be, became the starting safety. Shortly afterward, campus police stopped Joe Bob in his car and found a marijuana pipe. Darryl Royal responded by kicking him off the team 2 days before the season opener against Boston College. Raymond Claiborne returned a touchdown 95 yards for a score in that game, indicating that when it came to football, Darryl Royal had shrewdly gauged the expendability of Joe Bob Bissell. He had come back to the team in 1975 and returned a kickoff 50 yards in the Blue Bonnet Bowl against Colorado. But it was too late by then for Joe Bob ever to get on the right track again. He was arrested by campus police for public intoxication and expelled from school for a year in 1976. When he tried to come back to play football in 1977, the coach then, Fred Akers, told Bissell he didn't want him back. He thought about transferring to North Texas State or to Hawaii, but it got complicated and hopeless. "My life's never been the same since," said Joe Bob Bissell one afternoon day, 14 years later, at that moment when Darryl Royal had told him he was through and cut off his lifeline because of a marijuana pipe. "It ruined my career. I thought I was going to play football. I was good at football. It just changed my life." His face bore little resemblance to the one on the Wall of Fame, with little webbed feet around a pair of eyes that looked like brittle coals. He had a drooping, saggy mustache and black hair that fell below the neck. He He looked weary and exhausted, and he gave off a deep laugh every now and then that came out of nowhere. He was home watching